Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, February 8th, 2023. Section A. Chevron CEO notes value of Permian Ops by Mila McEwen. Twice a year, Chevron holds corporate town halls, events usually held in cities like Houston that are beamed to the company's facilities around the globe. Amid the COVID pandemic, Chevron Chairman of the Board and Chief Executive Officer Mike Wirth held the events by himself from corporate headquarters. This year, Wirth decided to break out of the corporate studio, bringing the town hall to Chevron's Midland campus to highlight its Permian operations and recognize local teams and innovations. In between meeting with various Permian Basin teams and preparing to hold the global town hall, he and Ryder Booth, Vice President, Mid-Continent Business Unit, settled into Booth's office to speak with the Reporter Telegram. Question. In your Permian Basin operations, what would you say is the most important thing to address? Emissions, flaring, water recycling and reuse, seismicity, or all of the above? Worth. For us, safety is the most important thing. Our people are doing difficult work in a challenging environment, and we want them to return home safely. Road safety especially is important, so safety is number one. The history of our company and industry is to make communities better. When you have a resource as prolific as it is here, and you scale up that development, it brings tremendous benefits to communities. But it also has an impact in terms of housing, schools, emissions. Question. You continue with your goal of 1 million barrels a day from the Permian by 2025, something you've stated for several years. Since that goal was first announced, how has it changed? Has it been impacted by the drive to produce lower carbon, responsibly sourced oil and natural gas? And does the world need 1 million barrels a day from Chevron, ExxonMobil, and Pioneer? Worth. That million barrels number is not really a goal, but an outcome of our efforts to develop our resources and create value. It's a guidance for our investors who like to know our plans. If we don't reach a million barrels, it's because we've decided not to. As to whether the world will need a million barrels a day, yes, absolutely. What we see in the world today, when markets are balanced in terms of supply and demand, is the risks to energy security are more evident. Energy should be produced by the most responsible producers. The Permian Basin has the lowest carbon, oil, and high security. It is absolutely needed and economic at a time when prices are creating pressure on economies and consumers. It's lower carbon and secure. When, again, it is absolutely needed, and it will be for a long time to come. At a time when there are calls from D.C. for more investment and more production, Chevron had the highest U.S. production in its history, 1.2 million barrels of oil equivalent per day, led by 16% growth in Permian Basin unconventional production, according to its fourth quarter earnings announcement. We're investing two-thirds of our capital budget in the U.S., we're responding to the call for increased investment and production. Booth. We're continuing to grow our investment in the Permian Basin from 2022 to 2025, spending $4 billion in 2023. Question: are there any new technologies Chevron is testing in the Permian Basin that people might be surprised to learn about? Worth: there are many technologies. There are hundreds of ideas in the works to improve performance, cost, recovery, our environmental footprint. One technology is a real-time autonomous optimizer. Traditionally, operators drive around managing tanks, compressors, pumps. When there's an issue, they have to drive from well to well managing those issues. This is a logic controller to help identify conditions quickly. We can set rules for it, and it can automatically make adjustments according to the rules we've established. It's reduced flaring over 50% and reduced the impact of well shut-ins. It takes people off the roads who would otherwise be exposed to safety risks. Another thing is, for several years, we've sent 40 to 60 of our bright early to mid-career professionals to MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and now Rice University, to study things like systems design, artificial intelligence, and machine knowledge. They now work with drones, and the idea of having drones with a base station in the Permian Basin where they recharge and every day they wake up and fly over our operations and use technology like high-definition topography, thermal imaging, methane detection. At night, when they park to recharge, they send in that data. That data is streamed and analyzed with artificial intelligence and elevated to a person who prioritizes issues. We have eyes on our assets at all times without having people on the road. It's more instantaneous information and allows operators to dispatch personnel to what they know are pressing problems. And we're just scratching the surface. Booth: it improves our operations, keeps personnel off the road and safe, and reduces carbon emissions. Question: you got into a bit of a tiff with the president last year over rhetoric regarding the oil and gas industry, over rhetoric regarding the oil and gas industry. Given how Russia's invasion of Ukraine has highlighted the need for energy security, do you see that rhetoric dying down? Is it easier for Chevron and your peers to make the case that you're being environmentally responsible and working to improve your environmental impact? Worth: I think it's helped the industry engage in a balanced conversation. The industry is about three things: affordable energy, which underpins economic prosperity, reliable energy, which underpins security, and environmental protection. Whether you're a company or a country, as you look at your energy responsibilities, it's important to balance those three things. If you overinvest in one, it creates unintended consequences. If you focus on affordable energy, you create environmental issues. If you focus on security, you recreate redundancies. If you focus on the environment, you create a system that's not reliable or affordable. Russia's invasion of Ukraine created a recognition of the risks. It helped create a more balanced conversation, but there are still some mixed signals. Europe wants U.S. gas imports today, but not tomorrow. The U.S. is calling for increased production today, but not tomorrow. It makes allocations challenging and decisions harder to make. People who don't work in the industry may not appreciate the timeline or the capital involved. Booth: It highlights the importance of the Permian Basin as a source of reliable, affordable, clean energy. Between 2035 and 2040, the Permian Basin will be responsible for 60% of all U.S. oil production. The Permian Basin will be unbelievably important. This is the basin you want to incentivize. Question. You're quite involved in the Permian Basin communities, part of PSP, the Permian Proud Digital Initiative. Do you plan to increase that involvement? And are there any areas you feel you haven't helped address? Worth. Chevron has been in the Permian Basin for 100 years and plans to be here for a long time into the future. We're proud of the investments we've made here that are in many ways matched and supported by our employees. They offer financial support and support with their time. Our workforce is incredibly generous in their time and commitment to the community. The world expects the industry to operate in a responsible way and to realize our impact on communities. That's why the Permian Strategic Partnership is so important for the industry to meet with community leaders and help allocate resources on a local level and ensure what we're doing has a positive impact. Booth. We're proud to be part of PSP. They've taken an investment of $93 million and leveraged it to $950 million. By partnering, we've been able to grow our investment tenfold in healthcare, education, and infrastructure, roads, and housing. We make the community better and attractive to employees. BizBuzz. Tall City Meat Market offers prime cuts in Central Midland, by Ben Schaefer. Michael Loya, the owner of Tall City Meat Market, spent 13 years in coil tubing in Texas oil fields. When he sought to change careers, he wanted to make sure he remained in Midland. West Texas seems to be a carnivore town. There's no doubt about it, Loya said. From the rig cooks, we'll have orders of 1,000 to 1,500 ribeyes go out to one rig, and they'll cook. Loya moved to Midland in 2015 to chase oil like everybody else. After a career in oil, Loya fell back to his mother, a meat inspector, and asked about changing sectors while remaining in Midland. That's when it came into play, the idea of opening a meat market, Loya said. There was only one in town at the time, which I think there might be two or three now. During his first year in the meat market business in 2020, Loya sourced beef from a private South Texas ranch near the Kennedy area. The advantage of the privately sourced Angus Wagyu meat, according to Loya, is the ability to serve a quality product that doesn't contain hormones or antibiotics. When you come in here, you know exactly what you're getting versus going to a grocery store where you might be getting a piece of meat that's full of antibiotics, steroids, stuff that you really don't want in your body, Loya said. He was motivated to bring a quality product to a community that needed it. He said his friends and contacts in the oil business are now great customers of Tall City Meat Market, which is located at 2909 North Big Spring. A seasonal promotion. Available for pickup now through Valentine's Day are heart-shaped ribeye steaks. During Tall City Meat Market's first year in business, 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic came around, and Loya wanted to provide a quality Valentine's Day dinner for those who couldn't go out to eat at a restaurant. The first year, just because everybody was stuck at home, we sold over 600 of them, Loya said. Last year, I think we sold another 550 to 600. This year, we've already got orders for 475. Loya said. He estimates more than 600 heart-shaped cuts will be sold again this year. The Wagyu cross steak is prime rated, and there is also Japanese A5 Wagyu available as well. Japanese A5 is the highest meat rating given by the Japanese government. It's a good way to go home and hang out instead of dealing with crowds, lawyer remarked. The steaks can be cut to the size and thickness preference of the customer, he added. County leaders want hike bike trail near Horseshoe Complex. By Ben Schaefer. The Midland County Commissioner's Court is moving forward with a new hike bike trail near the Horseshoe Complex. The court, during its January 23rd meeting, voted to move forward with the trail. Previously, the court set aside $500,000 for architectural services. Last month, Commissioner Luis Sanchez brought the request for proposals for architectural services to the court. The estimated 20-acre property has been vacant for many years and will be located west of the Horseshoe Complex. In the coming weeks, we will be forming a citizens' committee to help guide us through this process, Sanchez wrote in an opinion article that will run in the Reporter-Telegram this weekend. In the following months, we plan on presenting this initial plan to the public for comment. Partnerships in this process will be crucial. These partnerships will allow us to be an open coalition with the county, the community, businesses, and all taxpayers of Midland County. Midland County has been blessed by the revenues of our local oil companies, service companies, and indeed all oil and gas related businesses. This project is a great way for us to give back to our community. Sanchez described a hike bike trail as a thank you for the community for record-breaking sales tax collections and other community support. Midland ISD finds talent acquisition director at ECISD by Stuart Doreen. For the third time, Midland ISD Superintendent Stephanie Howard went to Ector County ISD to find a higher-ranking member of her cabinet. Howard selected, and the Midland ISD Board approved, the hiring of Jesse Garcia as Executive Director of Talent Acquisition and Development. Garcia's previous position was Direction of Talent Development at ECISD. Garcia has 9 years of administrative experience and 10 years of teacher experience, according to Midland ISD. She also will be returning to MISD, where she previously worked for 9 years. The job description for the position states the Executive Director for Talent Acquisition and Development is responsible for managing and developing processes and programs that drive the attraction, retention, and development of highly successful talent in all areas of the organization. Upholding the district culture and core values, the executive director plays an integral role in supporting the strategic direction of the district, specifically in the areas of talent sourcing, recruiting and selection, onboarding, performance management, personalized professional learning, talent development, and succession planning, the district states. The pay range for this position is $99,824.20 to $122,783.54, according to the district. Howard previously hired Robert Cedillo as the deputy superintendent and Ashley Osborne as associate superintendent for teaching and learning. MISD taps ex-Bonham principal for school leadership role by Stuart Doreen. When it came to picking an executive director of school leadership, Midland ISD Superintendent Stephanie Howard stayed close to home. Howard named and the Midland ISD approved the selection of Tricia Teron as the person who will supervise, monitor, and evaluate the performance of principals and assigned support staff. Teron has 6 years of administrative experience and 4 years of teaching experience. She previously served Midland ISD as the Director of Learning, Leading, and Innovation, and spent 4 years as the principal at Bonham, turning the West Midland School into a B-rated campus, according to the district. The district stated in a job description for the position that the executive director of school leadership will engage in effective professional learning strategies to help principals grow, use evidence of principals' effectiveness to determine necessary improvements in principals' practice to foster a positive educational environment that supports the learning needs of students, develop an overall strategic plan for elementary, junior high, and or high schools, identifies critical issues and resource requirements, and sets measurable and achievable goals focused on student academic growth. The pay range for this position is $99,824.20 to $122,783.54, according to the district. Greenacres mini golf burglar in big trouble, by Mercedes Cordero. Midland Crime Stoppers is offering a cash reward for information on a burglary at Greenacres Mini Golf. Midland Police Department officers received a report of a burglary of a building January 18th at the Greenacres Mini Golf, 2905 East Highway 80. According to a Midland Crime Stoppers Facebook post, the suspect forced entry and stole property from the business. If a person is the first to submit any information on the suspects and it leads to an arrest, he or she will be eligible for a cash reward. Call Midland Crime Stoppers at 694-TIPS or download the Crime Stoppers app, P3 Tips, and submit an anonymous mobile tip. No caller ID is ever used, and those providing information will remain anonymous. Reference MPD case number 23011802020. Pilot pleads guilty to plane crash, by Mercedes Cordero. A 46-year-old Seminole man is facing up to 20 years in prison after he pleaded guilty Thursday to transporting undocumented immigrants, causing serious bodily injury, according to the Justice Department. On December 30, 2021, Tobias Penner Peters piloted an aircraft carrying 5 undocumented immigrants and crashed shortly after taking off from the Presidio Airport. U.S. Border Patrol agents responding to the crash found the 5 injured undocumented immigrant passengers. Peters fled the crash site and was making his way to Mexico, according to the press release. 3 months later, he turned himself in at the Presidio port of entry. One of the passengers injured in the crash suffered a back injury, was life-flighted to an El Paso hospital, and remains in a wheelchair today, according to the press release. Peters is scheduled to be sentenced April 25th. Police hunt for wallet thief, by Mercedes Cordero. Midland Crime Stoppers is offering a cash reward for information that leads to the arrest of a woman who stole the wallet of a customer at TJ Maxx. The suspect entered TJ Maxx and stole another customer's wallet from her shopping cart when she wasn't looking, according to a Midland Crime Stoppers Facebook post. The value stolen will be $4,800. Felony theft. If a person is the first to submit any information on the suspect and it leads to an arrest, he or she will be eligible for a cash reward. Call Midland Crime Stoppers at 694-TIPS or download the Crime Stoppers app P3 Tips and submit an anonymous mobile tip. No caller ID is ever used, and those providing information will remain anonymous. Reference MPD case number 22121500001. Obituaries for Wednesday, February 8th. Betty Jones Van Wee. Betty Jones Van Wee of Midland passed away February 4th at the age of 96. She was born March 12, 1926 in Holland to Lorraine and Ralph Jones. She married Joseph Van Wee in 1951, the first couple to marry in the chapel on UT Austin campus. Betty is survived by her three daughters, Jerry Hudson of Dallas, Sherry and husband Leon Gentry from Horseshoe Bay, and Patty and her husband Mike Mayer of Midland, as well as six grandchildren and 15 great-grandchildren. Funeral services will be held at 1 p.m. February 10th in the chapel of First Baptist Church in Midland with Dr. Darren Wood officiating. In lieu of flowers, donations can be directed to Manor Park, First Baptist Church, Midland, or the charity of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Betty Lou Pendergraft Angelo. Betty Lou Angelo passed away Sunday, February 5th. Known by friends as Penny, she was born September 2nd, 1935 in Galveston, the only child of Clifford Eugene and Betty Arrington Bowles Pendergraft. She married Ernest Angelo in December of 1958. Penny is survived by her husband of 64 years, Ernest Angelo Jr., her children, Helen and husband Frank Kisner of Midland, Patricia Angelo of Midland, Ernest E. and wife Margot Angelo of Carmel, Indiana, Cliff and wife Jill Angelo of Austin, eight grandchildren, and two great-grandchildren. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, February 8th at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home Chapel with rosary to be recited at 7 p.m. Funeral Mass will take place at 11 a.m. Thursday, February 9th at St. Anne's Catholic Church. Burial will take place at 2 p.m. Friday, February 10th at the Texas State Cemetery in Austin. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Billy Perry, July 25th, was born and passed away Monday, February 6th, at the age of 94. Her parents were Tracy and Maggie Townsend. She married Troyce Perry in Abilene in 1947. Billy is survived by her son, Stephen, several cousins, and numerous friends. She will be buried next to her husband at Rose Hill Cemetery in Merkel. No services are scheduled at this time. Carol Faye Folger Sliger. Carol Faye Sliger, daughter, sister, aunt, wife, mother, and grandmother, and great-grandmother, has passed away. A memorial service will be held at 3 p.m. Friday, February 10th, at Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home in Midland. A graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, February 13th, at Walnut Grove Cemetery in Paris, Missouri. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notice. Minerva Badillo. Minerva Montoya Badillo passed away February 5th. A viewing will be held Wednesday, February 8th from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., followed by an evening talk at 5:30 p.m., all at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home and Chapel, 405 North Terrell. The funeral service is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net or on the web at llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com.
This is Thoris with Odessa American News for Wednesday, February the 8th. Headlines are Celebrating Black History Month. Read-in attracts a variety of presenters. A variety of speakers and storytellers took to the front of the multipurpose room at UTPB Tuesday as part of the annual African American Read-in. Held in the multipurpose room at the Mesa Building, it is one of many events planned to mark Black History Month. Iris Forger Hankins spoke virtually about gospel presentation and performance, and the keynote address was from storyteller Sue Roseberry. I'm excited about the opportunity anytime to share what I'm passionate about, which is storytelling. So I'm going to combine love of storytelling and my love of reading with Black History Month. So how can you lose? Roseberry said. She will be part of another Black History event called No Ways Tired at 2 p.m. on February the 25th at 1705 West Missouri Avenue in Midland. For limited seating, free admission tickets, visit nowaytiredevenbright.com. You can follow Roseberry on all the social media platforms, plus YouTube and TikTok. This is the first year visiting lecturer in the Department of Literature and Language, Leslie Milan, has helmed the event. Previously, it was Myra Salcito, senior lecturer in the Department of Literature and Language, and Rebecca Babcock, William and Ordell Watts, professor in the Department of Literature and Language. Babcock was presented with a surprise award for starting the program with Salcito, who was unable to attend. Tanya Lowry, Chief Compliance Officer and Interim Chief Diversity Officer, made the presentation. Babcock accepted Salcito's award on her behalf. Mallard said they both stepped down and stepped back from the read-in. We just wanted to say thank you for getting this started. It's been a real joy for me to take it over, Mallard said. She added that she volunteered for it. Dr. Salcito said in an email to our department that she was kind of taking a step back, and I just kind of jumped in and said, you know what, I'll do it. It was something of interest to me. I saw what they did last year with it, and I thought, oh, that just looks like a really fun thing to be a part of, and I would love to do that for this community, Mallard said. She added that Hankins does a lot of work with Black female gospel composers and is a professional soloist and performer herself. I really wanted to get her views, as this year's theme is hope and progress, and also a celebration of all Black authorship. That's where I saw the history of gospel fitting in as just one example of all the beautiful things Black authorship can be, Mallett said. About 50 people were in attendance, but she was expecting more. During the open mic sessions, everyone was invited to read and share their stories and celebrations. Outside of the performances from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m., Mallett said it would be come and go, and attendees could find community resources, volunteer and internship information for students. Asked if there would be discussions in addition to the performances, Mallett said she wanted to keep it more celebratory this year rather than lecturing. Part of that is because one of my colleagues, Mr. Clark Moreland, has put together two very extensive lectures for Black History Month, and I really want to encourage everyone to attend those. Those are on Microsoft Teams, and they are in the university's Black History Month event calendar, so the public can find them on our websites, Mallett said. He's introducing a new one on Malcolm X. You can attend the lectures in person or watch them on Teams. Board hopes Hispanic Chamber reboot is successful. Next month will mark 1 year since the president of the Odessa Hispanic Chamber of Commerce was indicted for allegedly stealing more than $52,000 from the nonprofit. The group now has a new president, and its board is ready to move forward. Since Paul Garza, Jr., 31, was arrested, Savannah Morales said the chamber has seen a dramatic decline in its membership numbers and lost some of its board members. However, five new board members were inducted in November, and she took on the title of Chief Executive Officer after Garza's successor, Benjamin Quiros, moved to Houston. The board is holding a meet-and-greet on Thursday at La Margarita Restaurant. In addition to herself, the board is comprised of Lucy Herrera, Erica Belanger, Natalia Ortega, Jonathan Futes, Nadia Rivas, Esperanza Garcia, Rosario Sanchez, and Mark Garcia. Since taking her seat, Morales has spent much of her time visiting with local businesses and other area Chamber of Commerce board members. She realizes she and the rest of the board have a daunting task ahead of them. In fact, unlike past years, the board has not sought funding from the city of Odessa. For now, they hope to run the organization with grants and membership fees, she said. We're going to have to prove ourselves to the community. Where others see uncertainty, because there was uncertainty at one point in the chamber, us new board members that came in, we see an opportunity, Morales said. We want to reprioritize the things that are very important to the community and very important to the small businesses and to us as board members. She's on the hunt for a grant writer right now because they realized just how deeply hurt the community was upon Garza's arrest. We want to make it more accountable, transparent, and we have a vision where we want to go with it. We're very blessed with the 8 ambitious board members that we have. I love it. We have the same vision, we have the same passion, and we want to see the community succeed, Morales said. The chamber wiped its membership slate clean, but now has 3 paid members, Morales said. Hopefully that will change with Thursday's meet and greet, she said. In addition to sending out invitations via email, the chamber has been promoting it on its Facebook page and handing out newly minted brochures. The chamber is committed to helping businesses and individuals reach their goals by providing help with marketing, networking, and educational opportunities, she said. The chamber will be publishing a biweekly newspaper and provide monthly classes on such things as financial literacy, grant writing, and bookkeeping. They've been working with the Ector County Independent School District to help newly arrived citizens enroll their children into school and have hopes of creating a mentorship program that would allow students to gain dual credits while working at local businesses, she said. They've also been discussing joining up with Frost Bank to put together a family financial literacy class for parents and their children. She's not yet reached out to America's Small Business Development Center at UTPB, but that'll happen soon, Morales said. She's also hopeful the chamber will be able to staff its office on 4th Street. Morales, who unsuccessfully ran last November for the Ector County Commissioner's Court, has worked off and on at Melody's Bakery for roughly 15 years. In addition to helping her husband's family with the baking, she's handled bookkeeping duties, payroll, and advertising. Morales met Quiros thanks to her involvement with Hispanic Heritage of Odessa and the League of United Latin American Citizens. He asked me if I wanted to join on the board, and I was like, I would love to. I would love to be able to get in there and make a positive impact in our community, she said. She thought she had something to offer. Being involved in a small business, I see a lot of opportunities. Not a lot of small businesses know about business credit, how to establish your business credit, and not use your personal credit, how to separate your business income from your personal income. A lot of times they don't even pay themselves as an employee, so it affects them when it comes time to retire. She's optimistic about the future, Morales said. We're just extremely excited. I love the leadership that we have in our board, and I love the passion that each board member has. We are all on the same vision, and we all want to see the community succeed, she said. Garza's trial is pending. Local news roundup. Woman arrested on possession suspicion. A call about a reckless driver led to a drug arrest recently. According to an Odessa Police Department report, someone called 911 to report a reckless driver near North Dixie and East University Boulevards. The caller said the driver of a Ford Focus was swerving from lane to lane and at one point was driving south in the northbound lanes of Dixie. When officers pulled Sadie Smiles Saucedo over, they found 5 THC pens and 6 M30 oxycodone/fentanyl pills in her purse. Salcito was arrested on suspicion of possession of a controlled substance, a state jail felony, and possession of THC, a second-degree felony punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. Texas man jailed in Dallas monkey case says he'd do it again. The Associated Press Dallas, a 24-year-old man now linked to an unusual string of crimes that kept the Dallas Zoo on the lookout for missing animals, told police that after he swiped 2 monkeys from their enclosure, he took them into the city's light rail system to make his getaway. Court records show. Davion Irvin also said he loves animals and that if he's released from jail, he would steal more, the document said. Irvin, who remained jailed Tuesday on $25,000 bond, was arrested last week after asking questions at a downtown Dallas aquarium about animals there. He is charged with 6 counts of animal cruelty and 2 counts of burglary. An attorney listed for Irvin in court records did not respond to a request for comment. Irvin told police that on the night of January the 29th, he waited until dark, jumped a fence to get onto zoo grounds, cut the metal mesh of an enclosure, and took the 2 Emperor Taramin monkeys, according to arrest warrant affidavits. He then got on the city's light rail before walking to the vacant home where he kept the animals. Police, acting on a tip from the public, found the monkeys named Bella and Finn on January the 31st, the day after they were discovered missing at the empty home in Lancaster, a Dallas suburb about 15 miles south of the zoo. Officers also found multiple cats and pigeons in addition to dead feeder fish and fish food that had disappeared from the staff-only area of the zoo earlier in January, but wasn't reported stolen at the time, affidavits said. Irvin has been charged in 2 of the odd events over a span of several weeks at the zoo and is linked to another, police said. In the taking of the monkeys, Irvin faces 1 count of burglary and 6 counts of animal cruelty, 3 for each monkey. He also faces a burglary charge in relation to the escape of a clouded leopard named Nova, who was discovered missing January the 13th. A cut was found in her enclosure, and the zoo closed as a search was launched. She was found later that day near her habitat. Irvin told investigators that he wanted to take Nova, but that he was only able to pet her before she got on top of her enclosure, an affidavit said. Police said they've linked Urban to the cutting of an enclosure for Langur monkeys discovered after Nova went missing, but he hasn't been charged in that. None of the Langur monkeys escaped. In the days leading up to the Emperor Taramin monkeys being taken, a man had been raising suspicions at the zoo, asking questions not only about moving and caring for such monkeys, but about the clouded leopard that had escaped, an affidavit said. He was also seen entering staff buildings near the monkeys' enclosure. After the monkeys were discovered missing January the 30th, police released a photo and video from the zoo of a man they said they wanted to talk to about the missing monkeys. The man in the images, who police later said was identified as Urban, prompted the tip that led police to the vacant home where the monkeys were found January the 31st. An affidavit said the tip came from a caller who said multiple attendees of a church recognized the man from the images as someone who frequented a vacant home owned by the church. Police arrested Irving on Thursday, a few blocks from the Dallas World Aquarium, after he'd been there asking questions about animals at the aquarium and a worker recognized him from news coverage. Chase leads to shooting suspect arrest. An Odessa man, wanted in connection with a December shooting, was arrested last week following a high-speed chase. According to Odessa Police Department reports, a 36-year-old man told officers he was sitting inside his camper trailer in the 1600 block of Doran on December the 6th when he was shot in the arm around 11:30 p.m. by someone who was standing in an alley near the trailer. A witness told officers Dylan Scott Kerr, 24, was upset with the victim and wanted to fight him, but ended up shooting him, the report stated. A warrant was issued for Kerr's arrest on suspicion of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and unlawful possession of a firearm by a felon since he'd been convicted of evading and a drug charge in the past. Court records also indicate that as a result of the shooting, his bonds in two pending drug cases were revoked and two additional warrants were issued. On January the 31st, OPD officers received an alert informing them a camera had spotted a Chevy Silverado associated with Kerr at 17th Street and North Grant Avenue, according to an OPD report. According to an OPD report, an officer tried to pull Kerr over at 8th Street and Grant, but Kerr refused to pull over and fled at a high rate of speed. The UTPB officers then tried to pull him over, but he led them on a high-speed pursuit, too, the report stated. Kerr crashed on the John Ben Shepherd overpass just south of Highway 80 and fled on foot, but he was found at a nearby hotel by a canine officer, according to the report. Officers found a small amount of marijuana in the truck, along with an AR-10 that had been reported stolen in Midland, the report stated. Kerr was booked into the Ector County Jail on the outstanding warrants, theft of a firearm, and possession of marijuana. He has since been released to federal authorities. U.S. District Court records indicate prosecutors filed a criminal complaint against Kerr February the 2nd, charging him with felon in possession of a firearm. According to that complaint, on January 17th, officers looking for Kerr in connection with the shooting found a .38 special revolver inside a stolen South Jackson Avenue trailer where Kerr had been staying. When Kerr was arrested on January the 31st, he told investigators he'd stolen the trailer and the AR-10 and the .38 special were his, the complaint stated. He also said the .38 caliber gun was probably stolen. Kerr also made the statement that he had a firearm on him when K-9 encountered him and he would have shot it out, the complaint stated. Under federal law, people convicted of being a felon in possession of a firearm face up to 15 years in prison. Kerr remains in the custody of the federal government and a preliminary hearing and detention hearing are set for February the 16th. Pregnant Odessan arrested. A pregnant Odessa woman was arrested Saturday morning after her boyfriend told police she pulled a knife on him. According to an Odessa Police Department report, a 24-year-old man called 911 from an apartment on Andrews Highway around 4:40 a.m. Saturday. When officers arrived, Kairona Ashante Cooper, 20, admitted she grabbed a large knife from the dish rack during an argument with her boyfriend, held it above her right shoulder, and pointed it at him, the report stated. She said she was trying to get him to move out of her way. Cooper was arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, family violence, a second-degree felony punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. She was released from the Ector County Jail Monday after posting a $20,000 surety bond. Odessa man tased and arrested. An Odessa police officer deployed his taser recently while responding to a family fight, and he also ended up having to make a felony arrest. According to an Odessa Police Department report, officers received a disturbance call shortly before midnight, January the 31st, from the 400 block of Wabash Avenue. When they arrived, they could hear yelling coming from inside the house and a man screaming for everyone to get out. When officers arrived, they encounter Rocky Enriquez Gonzalez, 38, who became upset with his sister for calling the police, the report stated. According to the report, Gonzalez adopted a fighting stance in front of a much smaller officer, and when the officer tried to convince him to go outside, he forcefully walked past him, ignored his commands, and fell onto a couch. When the officer tried to detain him, Gonzalez urged the people in the home to shoot the officer, the report stated. Gonzalez got off the couch and moved deeper into the house, and the officer tased him, the report stated. Gonzalez then kicked the officer in the leg and knee and tried to grab the taser off the floor, but was unsuccessful. Gonzalez was arrested on suspicion of the misdemeanor crimes of simple assault, family violence, and the third-degree felony charge of assault on a public servant. He was released from the Ector County Jail February the 1st after posting a $20,000 surety bond. Man accused in aggravated assault. An Odessa man was arrested on an aggravated assault charge Sunday after being accused of assaulting his roommate while wearing a set of brass knuckles. According to an Odessa Police Department report, a couple living in the Sedona Ranch Apartments on Brownstone Road told police Sunday morning they had an argument with their roommate, Gonzalo Barajas III, 32, around 1 a.m. Saturday because he'd brought a man into their apartment without their knowledge and had sex with him in the living room. The husband, 26, told officers that when he stepped outside of the apartment to discuss the situation with Barajas, Barajas began punching him in the head while wearing a set of brass knuckles and during the ongoing fight displayed a folding knife. The husband said he ran from the scene, and when he returned, Barajas was gone, according to the report. The couple called police shortly after 11 a.m. Sunday because they said Barajas came back to the apartment and threatened the husband. According to the report, the couple provided officers video surveillance that corroborated the husband's account of the assault. They also observed abrasions, cuts, and swollen areas on the husband's hands and a laceration on the back of his head. Barajas was not at the apartment when police arrived, but Ector County jail records show he was booked on suspicion of aggravated assault, causing serious bodily injury, a first-degree felony, shortly before 5 p.m. Sunday. He was released Monday after posting a $75,000 surety bond. Two arrested on drug charges. Two Odessa men were arrested on felony drug charges Monday after an officer said he pulled them over following a suspected drug transaction and he found them with fentanyl-laced pills, marijuana, and methamphetamine. According to an Odessa Police Department report, an officer and an intern were watching a house on Snyder Street Monday that is extremely well known for being a drug house. When they saw what appeared to be a drug transaction between people in a Chevy Malibu and a man standing in the roadway, the officer caught up with the Chevy and pulled it over in the 1000 block of Barrett Avenue after noticing several traffic offenses, the report stated. The officer wrote in his report that he handcuffed the driver of the car, Tyran Kishon Dominique Johnson, and sat him on the curb, but didn't search him because he was afraid the passenger, Christopher Eugene Fox, was going to run away. While he was detaining Johnson, the officer said Fox threw a clear plastic baggie containing 18 rocks of crack cocaine, worth $360, onto the ground. The officer found a loaded semi-automatic handgun on Fox's person, along with a digital scale, $96, and 3.9 grams of marijuana, according to the report. The officer then saw Johnson throw down a plastic baggie, stomp on it, and try to kick it as he walked back to him on the curb, according to the report. Johnson ended up sitting on the baggie, and when the officer retrieved it, he noticed 13 M30 pills, which are oxycodone pills that have been laced with fentanyl. Together, the officer estimated they were worth $260. When searching the car, the officers found 2 to 4 ounces of marijuana, the report stated. Each man was arrested on suspicion of manufacturer delivery of a controlled substance, tampering with physical evidence, possession of marijuana, and possession of methamphetamine. Johnson was also cited for failing to display a driver's license and failing to signal from a parked position, and Fox was arrested on suspicion of unlawful carrying of a weapon. Johnson remained in the Ector County Jail Tuesday afternoon on surety bonds totaling $68,000. Fox also remained in jail Tuesday on surety bonds totaling $52,000. Odessa man confesses to selling pills. An Odessa man arrested by undercover narcotics police officers after selling them M30 pills confessed to selling roughly 5,000 of the fentanyl-laced oxycodone pills over the last 5 months and 5 to 6 pounds of marijuana. According to an Odessa Police Department report, officers received a tip in November that Robert Heath Collins Jr. was selling M30 pills out of his house in the 1500 block of Broughton Avenue. On January the 31st, undercover officers bought more than 6 ounces of M30 pills from Collins and arrested him, the report stated. Collins confessed to selling the pills and marijuana after being Mirandized, the report stated. He was arrested on suspicion of manufacturing slash delivery of a controlled substance, 4 grams to 200 grams, a first-degree felony punishable by 5 years to life in prison. Collins was released from the Ector County Jail Saturday after posting a $75,000 surety bond.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.